Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
This is Patricia Camilleri, welcoming you to University Matters on Campus FM. In this series, together, we shall continue to discover more about the work of the university's academics and about the many activities that will be taking place on campus over the next year. I'm very happy to have with me today on University Matters on Campus FM, Dr. Giuseppe Schembri-Bonacci. He's a senior lecturer in the Department of History of Art. He graduated as a lawyer from the University of Malta with a master's from the State University of Kiev and read for his PhD at the State University of Moscow. He also undertook postgraduate research studies at the State University of Milan. Under A.N. Ovchinnikov, from the Moscow Grabar Institute, he pursued his artistic studies, specializing in Dürer and Rembrandt. And under V.V. Moroz, he studied the development and evolution of modern art. Dr. Schembri-Bonacci studied the art of stained glass under Joël Mon of the Lyon Academy in France. Besides lecturing in modern and contemporary art, fine arts and art theory at the University of Malta, he has exhibited his own artistic works in Malta, Paris, Lyon, Regensburg, Moscow and Canberra and other cities. He has led and participated in various art workshops in France, Bulgaria, Germany, Moscow and Australia. And today he's here to talk about his new book, which is entitled Shostakovich, Britain, Stravinsky and the Painters in Between, 1936. Welcome to the program, Dr. Schembri-Bonacci.
Oh, thanks a lot.
This book is thought-provoking, and I'm looking forward to our discussion or hearing your thoughts on the themes of this book. So perhaps you could help us by giving us a brief outline of the book, and after that we can look at the various themes perhaps a little bit more in detail.
Yes, but thanks a lot. Well, the main theme, the general theme that really determined and still determines my research, and when I say research, I don't really just mean academic research. This theme really is élan vital, I can say, throughout my whole academic life and even personal life, in the sense that I'm deeply interested in touching, in studying, in experiencing, call it what you will, the relationship between art and power. For me, this is not just a scholastic sort of university academic research point of view. On the contrary, I'm terribly interested to see how artists react to certain particular tragic situations, not just tragic in the extreme meaning of the word, but even how are we reacting to our own existence, let's put it this way. And this is not just an abstract definition. I mean, we have a relationship with our own being, right? So how are we reacting to our relationship to our being when trouble erupts? And this is fascinating. Well, I've lived quite a long time in the Soviet Union, so even from a historical point of view and even from a personal, I mean, I lived there, I experienced this particular point tangibly enough in my life. But then, slowly, I started to recognize that it's not only totalitarian states which has this kind of characteristic, even in democratic states. There are situations in which artists have to react or have to choose not to react. And this question disrupts me in a very positive way, since I think I would agree with Bergson and Husserl, for example, that artists or art is the sphere of activity that is the most, like a barometer thing, that it's the gauge as to what's happening to mankind. An artist is an artist because he has no right to choose whether to react or not. He has to react, otherwise it's not art. Art is the most sensitive vibe, the most sensitive vein, the most sensitive string, that when something happens in society, when something happens to our own definition of existence, then of course art reacts, whether it wants or not. There is no choice in this. That's why I call it the subversive character of art, because art has no choice but to react one way or the other. And this is the whole point in discussing this particular aspect. This is not a book about music. This is not a book about painting. This is a book studying the relationship between how art reacts to society's demands, let's put it mildly, for the time being.
You've taken the end of the 19th century and the first half of the 20th as your time frame for
exactly.
the book. But what has been the historic relationship between the power structure of society and art in its widest sense? You've said we're not just talking about painting here, we're talking about art in uh-huh. a wide sense. I ask you that question so that we can put your particular time frame in a general context.
Well, first of all, if I understood your question correctly, Patricia, in a certain paradoxical way, but I hope you and the listeners won't misinterpret what I'm going to say, I'm not very much interested in the linear idea of a historical analysis. You won't find this in this book, absolutely. I'm not undermining the importance of a historical analysis of political artistic situation, of course. What I'm trying here to unearth, at least, are concepts. What were the main concepts determining this particular relationship? That's why we come to great minds like the J. Clark, Baxendale, Gramsci, Marx, Panofsky. You have all these people who I do consider as giants of thought that were juxtaposing concepts as to how this power-art relationship is evolving. So yes, but I mean, history is very important also. So 1936, as you said before we start this program, is a sort of an anchor sort of thing. And why 36? Because I consider it as the epitome of the clash between modernity and previous ages, previous periods of history. Yeah, I mean, that's quite a subjective...
Personal.
Yeah, I wanted to choose it because 36 really, even historically now, with the Spanish Civil War, really created the schism between modernity and previous historical times. Of course, there is 1913 also, which is also a very important date, with Rabate's, for example, work. But 36 really, for me, equated modernity with totalitarianism. 1913 didn't do it. 1917 neither. But 36, I think, if I had to give a date, and a definition of a date, really defined our modernity as an age of totalitarianism. When I say totalitarian, I don't mean only Nazi Germany and communist Soviet Russia, of course not, even the West, in a subtle form, yes.
You start off with a chapter after your introduction called The Subversive.
Yes.
And this is like a leitmotif that uh-huh. runs through
yes,
the whole book. So I think it's important to look a little bit closer at exactly what you uh-huh. mean or what you feel subversivity, if uh-huh. one can say that, had a place in this period. As you said, 1936 epitomizes
yeah.
the essential characteristics of the 20th century. Totalitarianism in Spain, rise of national socialism,
yeah.
fascism, communism, etc. There were the artists that conformed under
yes,
those regimes, but there were those that didn't. And the subversive is obviously referring to those that didn't. So perhaps you can talk about some of those artists. You mention James Joyce, Finnegan's Wake, which of course is considered one of the publications, the books, that's really sort of changed literature and was highly criticized at the time. You mentioned Bulgakov's The Master and Margarita, obviously Picasso, Benjamin Britten, Auden. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about why you chose these artists, both
uh-huh.
musicians and
yeah.
writers
yes.
and
yeah.
artists.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes, of course. But I'd like to make one point, if I succeed in making it more clear. When I'm saying that art essentially is a subversive actio in itself, per se, I don't want to give the idea of a black-white situation, which you may inadvertently implied. So when one is saying, look, there are artists who did not conform and artists who did, and of course the former would be the subversive. No, that's it's not so clear-cut,
mm-hmm.
because what I mean by subversion is not only going on to the barricades and the trenches. You had Matisse, who did not consciously as a matter of principle, didn't go to trenches, not because he was a coward, but he believed, as Monet did, as Dostoevsky believed, that beauty only can save the world. And who is going to depict beauty when one is being killed in the trenches? Yes, you might say, well, that's an easy way. But I think, no, these giants didn't have these moral parameters. Clemenceau himself ordered Monet not to go to the first world, because we need your beauty, because who's going to defend beauty? Furt Wangler, the famous German orchestra director, who was Nazi Germany's director, who was then accused as being a collaborator, and it's beautiful, his defense, in which I do believe wholeheartedly. Who's going to conduct the Ninth Symphony, Beethoven, if I'm going to live as Thomas Mann did, as Hess did? Who's going to retain this breath of beauty within these Nazis' atrocities? So it's not a linear confrontation when I'm trying to define subversion in art. What I believe deeply as regards the essence of subversion in art is that only art can succeed in radically changing our structures of thought. Now, whether that could be a conservative painting, let's put it this way, I'm exaggerating a bit, or whether that can be a Delacroix liberty leading the people, the content doesn't disprove what I'm trying to say. Rembrandt's works were much more subversive than, let's say, the socialist realists in Soviet Stalinist Russia, although Rembrandt's content, just to give an example, is the portrait, self-portrait. Whereas if you take the whole itinerary of Soviet Stalinist socialist realist, you had all these revolutionary content, right? So which artwork is subversive? I have no hesitation to say Rembrandt's self-portrait, because through his self-portraits, Rembrandt is changing how we see the world, how we see our existence, how we perceive our existence. Whereas a whole 30 years of socialist, Stalinist socialist art just underlined that stability which was so needed by the Stalinist regime. So it is interesting as much as it is complicated.
Yes, one of my questions was going to be, art as subversive activity, is that always true? So you've answered.
You reminded me. For example, I took Picasso, right? For example, Picasso, and I compared Picasso's Damoiselle d'Avignon, which, I mean, simplistically said, has nothing revolutionary. It's a brothel, right? And you have Guernica. So I show these two examples. You have two really fantastic examples of how art can be, content-wise, can be subversive, as in Guernica, and even form-wise, how he created a new language, how to perceive the atrocities in Guernica. That's transcending Guernica. Today, we don't really need to know the exact historical documentation of the atrocities that occurred due to the bombardment of Guernica. But, I mean, it has become a sign, a symbol. With Demoiselle d'Avignon, you don't have that revolutionary, progressive content, but you have a dramatic change in artistic language. So we are perceiving Demoiselle d'Avignon in a language which was imposed by us, by Picasso. So our structures of thought have changed. Otherwise, we cannot accept that type of strange, bizarre language. Today, Finnegan's Wake is in the same position. You know much more than me, I think, how much it was completely ridiculed by Bernard Shaw. This is the end of literature. It's full of misprints, I'm quoting. And I really enjoyed writing this chapter because critics against Guernica, critics against d'Avignon, critics against Master Margarita, against Shostakovich Macbeth, used the same language, against Finnegan's Wake, you'll find the same expression. This is all Greek to me. And it's fascinating how, from West and East, one of the most fascinating things which I found was the great attack against Lady Macbeth, not by Stalin, but by the West, in New York, in Washington, in London. And it was a minority accepted Shostakovich, Lady Macbeth, the beginning, And so am I. I'm sorry.
it's fascinating. In fact, this is an interesting point that you've made, of course, that with sort of using a Western eye, we tend to look at the totalitarianism, and it's very convenient to think that it's everybody else's problem and not ours. But in actual fact, it was in America, as you say, the Lady Macbeth was also ridiculed.
It was called pornographic opera.
It takes time to make those changes. I mean, when you look at Demoiselle d'Avignon, it must have been very shocking at the time.
Exactly. And his own friends, even Kahnweiler, didn't accept it. His intimate friends did not accept Demoiselle d'Avignon. And Picasso dared to exhibit it after 27 years. Can you imagine? He was really scared of exhibiting, because his friends just, even Apollinaire, the famous Apollinaire, who really constructed the whole cubist terminology that we still use today, did not accept the Demoiselle d'Avignon.
This idea of how things were perceived at the time, because then there were people who were at their words,
yes,
really, at the
of
end
course.
Of the day.
Exactly.
I mean, the mode of perception, which is another theme which runs through this whole the whole book, is the mode of perception and visual behavior, I'm quoting you, constant throughout the ages, or do such categories depend on a specific historical period? So what you're saying is those who are looking at Guernica in 1936 and perhaps who can understand or are acquainted with the referent of Guernica can enjoy it, but it also transcends
to be a work of art, it must transcend. Otherwise, there is no evolution, there's no development of this particular new language. Today we accept it. Why? Because we have now integrated within our structures of thought, to use T.J. Clark's expression, our structures of thought today are adaptable to this kind of language. So we can communicate now. What is interesting is, it is a paradox in the sense that formally, or primitively, or rather simplistically, of course the 1936 people would understand Guernica better. But we know it better. They would, because our language today has evolved from that particular beginning of a new visual language, which Picasso's contemporaries could not understand. So the link between Picasso's work and the Guernica atrocity, yes, it was much closer to Picasso's contemporaries, but I think we know it better.
You use here, in the book, you use the example of Velázquez, the water cellar. We're talking about a 17th century painting. People looking at it at the time saw it in a particular way, would have understood it in a particular way. But it has, as the cliché goes, stood the test of time.
Yeah, of course.
And is still considered, or is considered now, as prime work of art. I was thinking of the Scrovegni Chapel frescoes, which, of course, at the time were painted for a particular reason, for a rather illiterate audience. They have colour coding, and they were appreciated at the time. The audience has changed now, but they have remained great works of art. So this transition is an interesting point. I mean, is there art that doesn't stand that transition? I suppose that would also be a question mark.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Although I hope I won't be misinterpreted as a snob, because I am. But I'm not really interested in works of art which did not stand the test of time. When you're studying, when you're researching, right, etc., you've got to choose milestone points. It's not possible to study the whole itinerary of art history, and for that matter for historical subjects and scientific and theoretical, I have to choose certain anchor milestone, which I do believe show a sort of course this is very flexible, because what today might be considered as a milestone by me in 100 years time would be considered as a secondary, relatively speaking, a weakish decision. But at least for the time being, I have to choose certain points, as though you're creating a map. So yes, you choose certain works which you do believe have, again, I'm sorry to go back to D.J. Clark and Baxendale, that participated, at least, put mildly, in our change of how we think. For example, in the Maltese situation, we have that phenomenal, I would call it really a phenomenon. It's Joseph Calleja, the sculptor. and he introduced a fantastic new language within this provincial island, which I do rate as a challenge to European artistic thought and philosophy. Whether he succeeded in, and that is why he is subversive, although he's very, very much, he's the most revolutionary artist we ever had, although the content doesn't really augur well for any foreign revolution down here, of course not. But his language is unique, and not only unique, it was attacking the whole concept of artistic language, the Caruana Dingley language, for example, the Napolitan language, which Maltese art formed part of, the Costumbrista tradition, which Maltese painting formed part of. Practically out of nowhere comes Joseph Kalea and introduces this phenomenal language. Of course it was not accepted, of course it was rejected. Vincent Apap's famous statement was that Joseph Kalea doesn't even know how to handle clay. Because Kalea introduced a complete different way of how we must perceive reality. Today things are changing, so our structures of thought slowly have evolved towards, let's put it this way simplistically again, I'm sorry, towards Joseph Kalea's language. Of course we do accept Vincent Apap's traditional language with all its modernist idioms. Of course, this is not a sharp-edged black and white discussion. I mean, it's a flowering of multi-mushrooming, right? One on top of each other, that's how we should see. And I got carried away, I'm sorry.
Not at all. You mentioned Baxendale.
Yeah.
He is another sort of leitmotif as far as concepts are concerned throughout the whole book. What are his main points?
That's a very difficult question because I am slightly obsessed by Baxendale. Mm. And he still does influence me a lot. But the particular element which might be the main leitmotif, at least one of the leitmotifs throughout the book, is how our perception changes. And I'd like, if you'd permit me, can I read a short,
please do.
And this really struck me really deeply. Looking at Della Francesca's resurrection seems dominated by the fact that how we come to see a thing tells us something about it. Now, if you stop and think, it's quite a simple statement, but it really troubled me a lot for months and months. First of all, because it's true, but secondly, because I could quite instinctively see his Gramscian link with that in this particular sentence. Because we see a thing not just how it is, the keys, but I'm seeing the keys just in front of me, subject to the baggage I have in my mind. That's the visual behavior element. So I'm not free to shadow this element of doubt that how I am seeing those keys just in front of me is also determined by my political baggage. And so even seeing, somewhere I did say it, did create a discussion in London, this center, even seeing is a political act. I mean, if you get Baxendale's, of course, Baxendale doesn't say this particular statement. What I'm trying to say is, from this particular statement, sentence, I developed it and gave it this political, because if I have a particular baggage, that particular baggage in my mind, in my brain cells, right, are determining how I am perceiving reality. And of course we can continue with Baxendale, because yes, you're right.
We can continue, but unfortunately we don't have enough time to continue, because I want to move on to modernity, because at the end of the day, I think it's one of the reasons, one of the most important things in the book is what's happening now. So in the last minute we've got, perhaps you could tell us what your opinion now of the modernity, how has it continued?
Well, I mean, I love to differentiate modernity from today. I think modernity is already a past age, so it is a bit difficult to answer within a few seconds this part, very important question. I mean, contemporary, today's art world, yes, has become a conglomeration of illusions and kitsch. And the Gramscian and the Greenberg definition of kitsch, in the sense that we are now, society has imposed upon us the the impossibility to see the truth. Society needs, today's contemporary society, needs to create a situation where the truth is no longer, not just possible, no longer needed. It's a choice. We don't want to know the truth. It's the virtual reality, the reality shows, the hamburgers. It's a whole the advertising thing, the globalization thing. I mean, the mass media. Well, we can keep on.
I think we're going to have edition number two of yeah. this yeah,
I'm,
discussion.
I'm stuttering because it's yeah. Anyway, with modernity, but this particular stage evolved because modernity, as I'm trying to say in my book, is really totalitarianism. Unfortunately, I'm against this because I'm very much emotionally biased in favor of the modernist movement a lot. I love all the modernist works, but slowly, I came to this bizarre conclusion that what James Joyce did, what Picasso did, etc., etc., my students won't believe this, yes, can be equated to the totalitarian evolution of European.
Sounds like a paradox.
Oh, yes, it is.
So we're going to have to leave it.
Just in brackets. In fact, if you watch Salò's, Pasolini's Salò, it's incredible because Pasolini's fantastic genius film, Salò, depicts this sort of castle of quasi pornographic atrocities. And you know what's hanging on these castle walls? Modernist paintings. The future is the cubist. And this paradox is incredible. Anyway.
Thank you very much, Dr. Giuseppe Schemri Bonacci, for coming to talk to us about his new book today. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye. Il-programm li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġju plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.